Hi, I'm Bill DeYoung, and this is Arts Alive, the St. Pete Catalyst podcast. Today, here again with L.L. Kirshner, one of our favorite people. I think I say that every time, but she's an author, and we're celebrating the third and final installment in her series, The Queenpin Chronicles. Hello.
Hi, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
This book, after Florida Girls and Vegas Girls, brings Thelma and the gang, as they say, into... more present times, but did you always envision this as a trilogy? I think that's what I would ask.
No, I didn't see it as more than a standalone novel. When I first started writing, this was during lockdown in 2020.
But right.
That's not when I first came up with the idea. That's when I first started writing the book. I had been thinking about this book since November of 2018 during a NaNoWriMo when I thought, I've been working on this memoir and trying to get that published for some time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't happening. So I thought, I'm going to try noodling around with this idea.
What's a NaNoWriMo? I'm sorry.
Oh, National Novel Writing Month.
Oh.
So the idea is.
Oh, excuse me.
You commit to writing, I don't know if it's like 1,500 words a day or 2,000 words a day. Really, it should be 3,000 words a day. Anyway, you commit to writing a chunk of words and you just rush it out there in order to have a novel at the end of 1 month. And
is that what Florida Girls came out of, with the first one in the series?
Yes, but I didn't complete the mission. The book that I'm writing now actually came out of another NaNoWriMo. I put Florida Girls, when I sent that to the editor, I started on the book that I'm now trying to write. And it's really hard to go back to a book that you wrote, 30,000 words, because I can't do 3,000 words a day for a month. That just doesn't work for me. But it's hard to go back to a book and just pick it back up. So anyway, back to this story.
Right. So if we haven't mentioned, it's called Havana Girls.
Havana Girls is the new one.
Yes.
So Florida Girls, again, didn't know if I could write a single novel. Ended up getting to the end of that story, and there was so much happening that I felt that this time period was a reflection of on contemporary times, that I wanted to keep going with the struggles that these women faced after the war. Mid-century America changed things for American women for forever. And, we're still not finished with those changes. But it's interesting to me look back historically and see how women's choices were so much more limited at that time, and the ways that they behaved often in response to that.
This is World War II era we're talking about, and it's very interesting to me that, especially in the first one, and it starts to sort of fade away, but it's still present in Havana Girls, that for a lot of them, home husband and home hearth husband, the white picket fence is still kind of the ideal, even though they're pulling away from that because they are finding strength in each other and what they do. There are still scenes in this one where somebody say, well, I'm going to marry him. Sam, for example, goes through that, and we're not going to talk about who Sam is for a minute. But she goes through that, and this is present day, and she's still thinking,
Well, present day, 1978.
Well, okay, present day, quite a few years ago. My point is, it's not World War II anymore.
Right.
But she's still thinking, can I make it work with my husband? Can I forgive him for all his ridiculous indiscretions and violent temper? And I'm thinking, no, you can't. And we won't say what happens. No spoilers here.
No spoilers. But I will say, it's funny that you would cite that specifically, because in some ways I modeled that character on my own emotional reaction to getting a divorce, in 2006, Cutter.
The Cutter episode.
And all that pathos, that kind of longing, that wanting to somehow salvage the bad decision that you made. And beta readers also, and I toned it down, I guess. I changed it. I tried to work on her motivation a little bit, because they said, this is just not realistic. You wouldn't have a woman with this sort of powerful, career-minded way that's still longing for her husband. And I thought, oh, honey.
But again, it worked for me, because I sort of thought that's this underlying thing that women had sort of been, taught, brainwashed into for so many years. And it takes a long time, if ever, for that to completely go away, I would think. That's the way I looked at it, because Sam is very independent and very, very smart.
Yes. And she
how could
also
she be
lost,
so dumb?
She lost her mother at a young age, yeah, which leads to abandonment issues. You know, bringing into contemporary times, if you look at attachment parenting theory, you know, she got sort of trapped in that unhealthy attachment because she didn't really grow up with her mother. And so that also feeds into it. But I don't use contemporary language like that in the book because it didn't exist then. Although I did try to throw in a funny way, she's studying forensics. And I threw in the contemporary at the time psychology, which that was amusing for me to research what they thought about things then.
As yeah, her professor would say this, and he comes up in her mind and stuff. Let's set the stage a little bit. Thelma has, you know, freed herself in a way, a manner of speaking, from Sal, her father, the mobster, and gotten out of Vegas and that whole thing. And now they're in Havana, and it's the very end of the 1940s. They're trying to figure out what she and Peggy and the others, they start a nightclub. That's fair to say so far.
That's right. Well, that was their dream at the end of Florida Girls. They talked about it because Doris and Helen, who are the money bags of the operation.
Right.
They happen to be a lesbian couple. They want to live in Havana because they had experienced its sort of laissez-faire nightclub culture.
It's
which
Paris
they soon
in the
discovered,
20s.
Right, yeah. But they soon discovered that didn't really extend beyond the nightclubs and even within the nightclubs. Mm-hmm. And I that theme is very present in this book, the struggles that they had and how they dealt with that.
So Thelma is still technically married to George Wright, who is MIA from the war, right? She doesn't really know where he is. Sal's in and out. Let's just put it that way.
Okay. I like it.
But he is, in a way, a very major character in this story, too. But they're in Havana, and it starts with the loss of a favorite character. So anyway, so that's the setup here. And there's all sorts of nefarious things going on in which Thelma has to be stronger than strong. And she faces a lot of demons in this one. Kathleen Young's in here. The gang's all here, as they say. How much of Thelma is in you? I asked you this before. I may have asked you this with both of the first books, because she's our not only a protagonist, she's kind of our narrator. She's our what do you call the central character?
Right.
And but she sort of leads us through the story.
Right.
She's our anchor. Is she you?
Well, I would say every character is me, and none of the characters are me. I try to imbue them all with their own personhoods, and they make decisions that I would not make.
Yeah.
And that's the fun about putting characters on a page, is you get to imagine lots of scenarios for them to act out. But the thing about that was very important to me for Thelma and all of the group was something that I read a lot or see a lot in television, where, not to be a downer, but alcohol use and drug addiction are shown, or you know, use of substance abuse is shown as a way to enlightenment or to loosen up or to get through rough times. It's really used as a device, and there are rarely consequences. I was reading a book this morning where after unleashing a reign of holy terror on this organization, like murderous rage terror.
Right.
This woman like lies down in a field and proceeds to smoke a joint. And, you know, I just thought, and also, by the way, they're still searching for her. And that just didn't, A, it didn't feel very realistic, but B, it certainly felt like something that was not making enough of an issue of substance abuse. So I chose for this character to have to actually reckon with that. And as you know, in my own life, I have had to reckon with that.
Well, going to tastefully bring it up, but you know.
Well, it's in two memoirs, so yeah, it's not a secret.
But that's one of the reasons I thought that Thelma may have had a big piece of you, because she certainly grapples with this.
Yes.
In this book.
Right. You know, as I said, of course she does, but then so do all of the characters. And I'm not, you know, an Italian mafia man either, nor am I a former child prostitute. So lots of differences between me and these characters.
Oh, that one sequence where the first attempted rescue was just heartbreaking.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That was rough.
Ooh, that Carlos. Ooh, what a bastard.
Isn't he creepy?
Oh, man. Good villain. Good villain.
He is a good villain.
Listen, can I go back for a second? Because I don't think we answered the first question. I think we gotten...
About the standalone novel?
About the fact that it's a trilogy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, how did that happen?
Well, so, again, I was... The characters were still speaking to me. And so it made sense to send them to Las Vegas. And that book was actually supposed to be Thelma getting revenge. That is not what happened. My father died in December of 2021 while I was working on that book. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't write a story where the whole idea was kill dad, right? Mm-hmm. It just, and so.
Been there, done that.
All right. Yeah, and so things really changed. And I also, you know, she had injured him seriously in the first book. And in Vegas Girls, she sees him as being less than immortal. And it changes her perception of him throughout the story until, you know, the ultimate decision is not to tear him down, even though she could have. And then the reason that I wanted them to go to Havana is because that was, of course, the other place where the mafia had a huge influence at that same time.
Yeah.
But it turned into a dual timeline situation when I started researching the Black Dahlia, which came up first while I was doing Florida Girls, but then even more so during Vegas Girls, because I was trying to figure out a way to give that story some prominence, because I find it was such a tragedy, and that it's still unsolved is so strange to me, especially when you consider the Agnes Underwood connection. So she is the city editor of the San Francisco Examiner, and she got that job after being a crime reporter for a long time, and she was the first on the scene of the Black Dahlia case, and she got very close to cracking the case, if not actually cracking the case. And then suddenly she was moved into another role and told not to pursue this. And so I imagine
you had to figure out a way to work this into your sequence of events, though.
That's right.
To your universe.
That's right.
That's pretty clever. Good on you. Which you did, and our friend Imogene, unfortunately, you have to read the book, folks. We mentioned it briefly before. So, in other words, I remember you telling me, LL, that after the first one, you said the characters said, wait, we got more to tell you, that there's more to this story, you're not done.
Mm-hmm.
So did that happen at the end of Vegas Girls, or were you already thinking, I'm going to put them in Havana. Did you know already?
Oh, I definitely wanted them to go to Havana to have this. But at first I was thinking it would be this sort of gay cabaret whole thing. But then when I started researching, I realized that was a fantasy that never really existed. For a brief time during the actual war, when there weren't a lot of men around in particular, it was much more common to see open homosexual activity in a Havana nightclub. Mm-hmm. But then after that, things reverted. And so I couldn't, in both cases, I started off with one idea in mind and I couldn't write the book because I wanted them to all have sort of a happy ending. I wanted it to, you know, have this fun and games kind of thing. It's not quite what happens, but it is quite what happens. So, you know.
I'm looking forward. As I told you before we went on here, I haven't quite finished it yet. I'm very close. And I have a couple of questions I want to ask you after we're done here. No spoilers. That's a motto around here at Arts Alive.
Well, I did email to people on my email list the prologue, which came after I had originally written the first chapter came to me before the prologue, and I sent that to everybody on my email list and talk about it a lot. So it's
okay. Well, yeah, I think I'm on your email list. I have to go and find that.
Oh, there you go.
One of the things I wanted to say, you talk about you know, Havana and I guess the 30s and the 40s, is I just remember those sequences in The Godfather Part Two where they're in the nightclubs there and it's all this stuff going on, and it was like, holy, was it really like that, you know? And it was pretty wild stuff.
Complete decadence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess it was.
Yes.
What's new in your life? You've always been a seeker, you know, always looking for something or someplace new. I mean, as evidenced by your earlier life, which you talk about all the time, the memoirs that you've written. What's new in your life? What's the next satisfying plateau for you to climb up to?
Well, did I tell you we moved downtown?
I don't think you did.
We moved downtown.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Hey, did you move downtown?
Yeah, I did.
All right.
So that's been fun because I like the walkability of being in downtown St. Pete. Uh-huh. I think it's a great city, and it's so strange to me because, you know, my grandfather lived here. I don't know if you knew that either. He and my...
Oh, he ran the Sun City Emporium, I think.
I wish.
Your grandfather, Lloyd Young.
No.
Sorry.
Actually, Lewis Kirshner was his name. And he and my... his wife, Anna was her name. And mm-hmm. then his ex-wife, who was my Nana, they had lived in Chicago. And then when Lewis and Anna got married, they moved down here to St. Pete. And we used to come and visit him mm-hmm. during the summers. And I have fond memories, but not of a place that is a vibrant city. More like, oh, we're going to go to the beach. Yay.
There was nothing going on here for years, except it was beautiful.
Right.
You know? Sure.
Right. And so, well, and I, the other thing I remember, the sprinklers, because it always smelled like rotten eggs.
Oh, yeah.
The sulfur of the reclaimed water.
My childhood has a lot of that in it, too. I grew up here, but yeah. So, in other words, does it sort of feel like going home to you in a way, moving to downtown? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, because it's not at all like what I pictured when I was a kid.
Well, this is true.
Sort of livable downtown area where I can go to a grocery store, go to a restaurant, you know, do some shopping, and I don't have to get in my car. I wouldn't have had to have gotten in my car to come here today, but I didn't want to be a sweaty puddle when I arrived. So you're welcome.
Well, yes, thank you for that. Thank you for that. So, I mean, HSN is a thing in the past now. I mean, in everybody's life, apparently.
I know, right?
So
strange.
Do you miss it?
Well, I mean, of course. I worked with some really interesting people. I had some really interesting times. I imagine that will work its way into my fiction at one point because that's where my imagination really takes off, is from things that I have partly experienced firsthand and make me really curious.
Is that right? What you know? They do say that, you know, at least start with what you know.
Yeah. I mean, if I was limited to writing with what I knew, I wouldn't have a book, I don't think. but I love doing research, and that's one of the things I like about the historical era, I guess, although my next book is set in 1990s Pittsburgh. Although, interestingly, Bill, that is now called historical fiction.
So, okay, explain that one to me. I mean, I understand what historical fiction is, but how is that different from, I mean,
I believe if it's older than 25 years ago, it's considered historical fiction.
Does that mean that Florida Girls is historical fiction?
Oh, yeah. Those are all historical. These are classic historical fiction.
For some reason, I thought historical fiction was. And then George Washington bought his 17th horse and, you know, like taking things that actually and just moving them around. These people didn't actually exist.
Well, no. I mean, Bugsy Siegel existed.
Well, yeah, Meyer Lansky, okay.
The Boleta Wars happened. I mean, this is all based on true stories.
You know, I got a thought bubble going on here, light bulb or something, is historical fiction, man. I get it. Look at this. The first historical fiction I ever read was I think it was called The Diaries of Henry VIII, big thick book about that.
Oh, yeah.
Thick. Do you remember that one?
I do.
And it was totally made up bullshit, you know, but it was fascinating. You know, it was written by somebody who knew what they were doing and researched and all of that.
Right.
But that's what I always thought of was historical fiction. It's like, we're going to pretend this actually happened. It's that real.
Yeah.
I guess I get that feeling from your, now that you mention it, I need to just shut up because I think you've convinced me.
Well, you used the word immersed when I got here to say you're really immersed in this world.
In the world,
now, which
yeah.
is what good historical fiction will do. Have you ever read I, Claudius?
No.
Oh, that's another one of those tome-like books.
And I think I read I, Claudia, but that was the other
sounds
one.
Like a dangerous version
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, that was the other one. Yeah, it was a different, it was a lifetime ago. Yeah.
Or it was a lifetime movie. Anyway, I, Claudius, it was a great book. But any book that is going before we have significant historical written record, and even written records, I mean, look at what's happening in the news landscape today. Mm-hmm. you know, the only way to know what happened is to experience it. And as someone who studied a lot of neuroscience, I can tell you, even experiencing a thing, two different people will walk away with two different interpretations.
Right. So any kind of written account of anything needs to be taken with some kind of salt.
That's right.
Right.
And when the people, when you start to wonder about the people who aren't written about, like in this case, and with the mafia in particular, yeah. I mean, we've got loads of stories of mafia men.
Yeah. Yeah. She's shaking her head. No, where are the mafia women? You know,
and there are some. Like there's a book by a friend of mine, Tori Teffler, Confidence Women. That's a great one. But that's a nonfiction account of some mafia women who have, you know, left a bloodthirsty trail in their wake.
Ooh, that sounds interesting, but it's nonfiction. Yeah,
right.
It's like a Dateline episode. Right.
Right. Yeah. Right. And there are some stories about rum runners out of Key West. Nothing too substantive about those women. But by all accounts, they were essentially pirates.
You have an event coming up July 1st at Book and Bottle, I think.
I do. I can't wait.
Well, tell us what happens there. You get up and you read from the book?
I'm there. I'll talk to people. I'll read. I'm going to read the prologue. That's my plan.
Yeah.
But I'll chat with people, sign some books. You know, their happy hours are 4 to 6 p.m., so it's in the late afternoon. So I'll probably, you know, I'll wait until after 5. So some people might come and we'll just chat.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
it's pretty informal. But I love that space because it's a beautiful space. They have a great charcuterie board and they have lots of delicious coffee drinks. And for those who like to imbibe, they have a full wine menu.
Yeah, back when I was a wine drinker, I used to, you know, I used to enjoy sitting there at that counter at one of those tables.
Well, you can still sit there with coffee, Bill. Yeah, That's what I do.
And we'll make that happen. We did it. Was it for the first book or the second one that we did a thing at Tombolo together where I sort of interviewed you? I don't remember which one that was. I think it might have been the first one. Look, see, that's it imprinted on your mind. I can tell.
It was actually for Blissful Thinking in September of 2023.
Bill. Oh my God! Blissful Thinking, of course, was your second memoir,
right?
And the Cutter one, which has a different title, and you changed it. What's the first one called?
American Lady Creature.
American Lady Creature. Okay, and I always mispronounce Cutter, but I remembered this time.
It was
23 that we did that thing, Mike. God. So before we close here, let's make sure everybody knows who your publisher is and how they can get these books. All three of them.
Well, all three of them are available anywhere books are sold. Locally, I know they have copies at Tombolo Books, at Book and Bottle, and also at the Gilded Page Bookstore in Tarpon Springs.
In Tarpon Springs. Yeah. Nice place. Yeah.
And you can get all three or order them if they're not in stock.
Very cool. L.L. Kirshner, always a pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure.
And I can't wait till the next one, and we'll have to do this again.
Yay.